It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great to be with you today. Lots to run through. By the way, if you want to get us on the internet, live stream on the internet, WABCRadio.com is one way to do it, or just LarryKudlowShow.com. You can get us all across the country and around the world and throughout the solar system. We have a terrific following around the solar system. And incidentally, during the week on Fox Business Television, the name of the show is Kudlow, and it's 4 to 5 p.m. every single day. And please watch it. If you can't make it at 4, you can call up your favorite 9-year-old who will show you how to DVR the show. So that's our communication story. I want to begin today with the tragic assassination of former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, who I knew rather well through various meetings. As director of the National Economic Council, I also was the international Sherpa for various G7s and G20s and UNs and whatnot. And I want to extend my very sincere condolences to the family of Shinzo Abe and also to all the people of Japan. And I want to say Mr. Abe was a conservative reformer. He was a great believer in free and open discussions, free and open Indo-Pacific strategies. He was the guy that came up with the Indo-Pacific idea, which strategically became a very important point for the United States. Abe understood quite clearly the threat from China and Xi Jinping. And so he set up what became known as the Indo-Pacific strategy. And the cornerstone of that strategy was Australia, India, Japan, and the United States. Japan was and is our greatest ally in the Indo-Pacific area. Australia, I might add, is also a great ally. And in many ways, India is also a great ally. But, of course, my disappointment in India, because they are helping Russia in the Ukraine war by buying a lot of Russian oil. They're buying 1 million barrels a day. That's restocking Russian cash to finance Putin's military war machine. Very disappointed in India, but India has always been an ally, particularly with respect to defending against China. And Prime Minister Abe was a leader in creating that quad, if you will. You know, spending a lot of time with Abe in these various meetings, as I said, G7, G20, UN, he made many visits to the White House, many lunches in the cabinet room with the president. I was there, I guess all of them, at least for 3 years. And even Mar-a-Lago, there were a beautiful luncheon. I guess I'm going to say two. A dinner and a lunch in Mar-a-Lago with President Trump and Prime Minister Abe. There may have been more, frankly, but you get to know people. And I always believed that the former prime minister was head and shoulders above all the other, you know, big shot heads of state that we came into contact with. Head and shoulders. He was a brilliant politician. He was a great leader of Japan. He worked very hard, not only with the U.S.-Japanese alliance, not only with President Trump, they were great friends, but also At home, Abe was an economic reformer. He tried hard to reignite the Japanese economy. I'm not sure he was able to succeed, but Abenomics became a catchphrase. And I always thought, frankly, although he pursued Keynesian policies in Japan, his motives were good. I don't think his specific operations were great. They were not. I used to say this at almost every meeting with him. Cut taxes, deregulate, cut taxes and deregulate. Japan, as you may know, is a very tightly knit, centralized economy. There was a time when it grew at 4, 5, 6% every year, but they have not done that, I don't know, in 20 years, 25 years. But I thought that Abe's great, really great contribution to the American relationship, to defending against communist China, was in the military and foreign policy area, where he elevated Japan. He really reinvigorated, resurrected Japan as a major world player. He beefed up the Japanese defense budget. He ran it the highest it had been, I don't know, probably since the end of World War II, and became a strong voice on the world stage. And it's interesting, yesterday, actually, I think it was Thursday night, President Trump called me on another matter, not Abe, but we got around to talking about the terrible, terrible news. I think National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien got the news from the Japanese foreign minister, or foreign ministry, and then immediately texted President Trump to let him know. Trump called Robert back. Robert was on our TV show talking about this last evening. So anyway, President Trump called me about trade, and then he also called me again on yesterday about the jobs numbers, but we got around to talking about Abe. Trump really loved Abe. He regarded Abe as his closest friend, his closest ally, and by far closer than any other of the G7 leaders or the G20 leaders. Because Abe was so supportive, Abe loved America, and realized how important it was to praise America, to bring out the best in America. You know, you had all these heads of state in Western Europe particularly, but not only, you know, a bunch of ankle biters, honestly, a bunch of little ankle biters, really. On the whole, I would call them small men. And I would call Prime Minister Abe a great man, a Japanese patriot and a great man, and Donald Trump's closest head of state friend by far. And I tell you a quick anecdote about this. We were in a UN bilateral meeting with President Trump and Prime Minister Abe. And I witnessed what I think was the single best presentation I saw in my 3 years as the NEC director and international Sherpa. So, you know, there were threats. Japan has a fairly protected economy, and their trade policies lean towards protectionism. But Abe was bound and determined to open that up as, you know, part of his effort to make a stronger economy, and part of his effort, I mean, he wanted free and open trade, not only in the Indo-Pacific, but with America. Abe understood, and he needed America to be strong and great in order to fend off China and Russia, for that matter, and even some of the craziness in Europe. So Abe pulls out this 50-page chart book showing President Trump with great clarity, I mean, charts and bullets, that Japan is America's best trade ally, top investor, and top manufacturer. And one of the great slides in that 50-page chart book, more Japanese cars are made in America than in Japan. And in fact, more Japanese cars were made here in America than produced by all but one U.S. car maker. I think Ford tied the Japanese cars. But that was all. And I'll tell you, it was a jaw-dropping presentation. And as the prime minister went through his paces after that, and Trump loved it. He was totally focused. President Trump loves, you know, good, well-made chart books. And all of a sudden, talk of trade protectionism, which could have come up in that bilateral meeting, was completely cast aside, permanently, no more. And instead, I think that chart book opened the door to a new era in U.S.-Japanese trade, an opening of U.S.-Japanese trade, where subsequently, in the next couple years, U.S.-Japanese trade improvement deals were struck. I mean, it was just so good. You cannot believe it. Not vague and general and platitudes like these other heads of state always do, and it's just blowing hot air and so forth. This was like hard facts. And the end of the chart book presentation, Mr. Abe just said his goal here was not simply to stop protectionism between the two countries, but to open up trade to mutual advantage. And it was fabulous, and it worked. And I'll say another thing here. Prime Minister Abe is always very kind to me personally. And, you know, over a period of 3 years with many, many meetings, I mean, you can imagine it would be important. Very kind to me personally. And after and thankfully minor cardiac episode, I'll call it, every time he saw me, whether it was in the White House or G7 meetings or G20 meetings, or I remember bumping into him in one of these crowded corridors at the UN meetings, when he was walking to another meeting and he had several, his foreign minister was there, finance minister, he stopped, saw me, walked over, put his hand out, and wanted to know how I was feeling. And virtually every other time I saw him, I mean, it might have been in our cabinet room, a luncheon with President, Prime Minister Abe would walk around the long table and put his hand on my shoulder or give me a handshake and just wanted to know how I was, how was my health. And I appreciate that a lot. And that's the kind of man he was. He was a great Japanese patriot. He was America's most loyal supporter. And in my best plain English, he was what you call a great man. His assassination is a terrible, tragic event. And also a tragic event with respect to the whole free world and the movement towards freedom and openness and the coalition of the willing to defend against China, which is so important. Again, my deep, sincere condolences to Mr. Abe's family and to the entire Japanese nation. We lost a great man, truly. May God watch over him, and may he rest in peace. We'll take a quick break, and I'm coming right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I want to turn now to the economy. We had a jobs report yesterday. It was a stronger than expected report, I think. It wasn't quite as strong as some people have made it out to be. But I'll make this point, a couple of key bullets here. That report, plus 300,000 jobs after the prior 2 months were revised down by 70,000. I think that report will guarantee that the Fed will increase its policy rate, so-called Fed funds rate, by 75 basis points when they meet again. The FOMC meets at the end of this month. And I would also think they will increase their target rate by another 75 basis points at the September meeting. Sounds like rough stuff, but they got a lot of catching up to do. After the 75 basis point hike last month, you were at a 1.75% Fed funds rate, just under 2%. The CPI inflation is running at 8.6, and the consumer price deflator, which the Fed watches, is above 6. So you still have a deep negative policy rate, and they're going to have to raise that policy rate above the inflation rate. And it's going to have to get, I'm going to suggest to you, it's going to have to get to 6% before this is all said and done, and I hope that's enough. Meanwhile, the Fed will be removing excess cash from the economy. The money supply, M2, is now slowing down from a peak of about near 30% 18 months ago. It's now slowing down to something around 6 or 7%. We'll talk about this with monetary expert John Hartley later in the show. Hopefully that will conquer inflation and it won't reminisce over the 1970s, hopefully. Jay Powell's talking tough. He's regained his inflationary manhood, it seems. He's growing new hair on his chest, it seems. He and the Fed completely bungled the inflation story for the past year and a half, but they're getting some religion now. And I'm just suggesting that the Fed is more determined to fight inflation rather than recession. That's their line right now. Inflation is far more important than recession. They will risk a recession, and they're going to get a recession. They're going to get a recession. I don't know if we're in it now. Maybe we are. The first quarter was minus 1.6%. The second quarter, according to the Atlanta Fed GDP tracker, they have it now at minus 1.6%. It was as deep as minus 2.1. So now they're at minus 1.6. And you could have a first half with a negative GDP, something like 1.5% negative. And it'll be accompanied by, 8% inflation. So it's difficult. We're at least on the front end of a recession. And we may already be in one. I would note in yesterday's jobs numbers, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but another measure of jobs called the Household Employment Survey, which tends to pick up individual family members and smaller businesses, and that's really, frankly, in the longer run, that's the more important of the two indicators, because that's where the unemployment rate comes from. Now, unemployment stayed low at 1.6. I beg your pardon, 3.6. Unemployment stayed low. But, household employment fell by over 300,000. This is the second month in the last three that measure fell. And it's actually, the three-month average is actually minus about, 160,000. So beware, caveat emptor. Caveat emptor. And finally, the wages, production worker wages, working folks, middle class, blue collar, hard hats, etc., their wages increased 6.4% over the past year. That's about the same as the prior month. I think it was down a tick. But recall the CPI is rising at 8.6. So 6.4% is, a couple percentage points in negative territory. In effect, working people are being paid more, right? But their wages are buying less. Dollars have been devalued because of the high inflation rate. Disposable income after inflation is down 3.3% for the past year. So my own view is, caveat emptor, beware. We're headed towards a recession if we're not already in one. And many other measures like real income and real wages and real retail sales are showing that. So, take a quick break here. And when we come back, I want to talk a little about the stupidity of the latest Build Back Smaller Democratic package. I say save America and kill this bill. Save America and kill this silly bill. I'm Kudlow.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I want to touch on one other subject. We're going to bring in former OMB Director Russell Vogt, served under Mr. Trump, talk about this at greater length. Russ is a great expert. I started my career as an OMB deputy for the economy under Ronald Reagan. I think I was 15 years old. Anyway, there is this effort by Biden and the Democrats, particularly Chuck Schumer, to generate a reconciliation budget bill that would spend roughly another $1 trillion and raise taxes on large and small businesses for about another $1 trillion tax hike. It's being referred to as Build Back Smaller, BBS. And it is a terrible idea. The additional spending will raise the inflation rate, and the tax hikes will deepen the recession. It is as though the Biden Democrats have learned nothing in the last year. You know, recall, of course, in March of 2021, they passed a $2 trillion spending bill, and that was one of the key triggers for this rapid inflation. And the Federal Reserve supported that bill and proceeded to buy the debt that the government spent, the federal government spent, deficit finance, the Fed bought the bonds, pumped up the money supply, and that aided and abetted the inflation. It's like, here they go again. Here they go again. The spending would steepen inflation. The tax hikes would deepen the recession. It's crazy. And although we don't know all the details yet, I mean, they're going to spend on the Green New Deal. They're going to spend on boosting Obamacare subsidies. They're going to spend on more Medicaid subsidies. And Lord knows what, you know, when this thing finally gets fleshed out, if it ever does. They're going to tax small business. They're going to tax LLCs. They're going to tax subchapter S, okay? Which is, you know, basically small American business run this economy. They want to extend the 3.8% net investment tax. That was originally put in Obamacare to finance Obamacare. But they, at that time, they did not tax the pass-through companies. Again, the LLCs and wholly owned proprietorships and so forth, subchapter S. So now they want to go extend that and hit all of the so-called pass-through companies. Allegedly to boost or reinforce Medicare. And by the way, Medicare drug controls would be part of this. That will do great damage to our brilliant pharmaceutical and biotech companies, which, by the way, produced the vaccine in the Trump Operation Warp Speed. We'll talk about that with Russ in just a minute. But it's a terrible idea. I don't know if it can get through. I don't even know if they can get reconciliation judges to accept it. Once it goes to the House, you can bet all the crazy lefties in the House will increase or try to increase spending and try to increase taxes. But it is simply a terrible bill. It's like, here they go again. They've learned nothing. and it will do even more damage to this economy than they have already done. And in 18 months, they've taken a strong economy and pushed it into a high inflation recession. The worst of all worlds. Milton Friedman called it inflationary recession. It's insane. And that's why I will say again and again, save America and kill the bill. We'll take a quick commercial break here and bring on my good friend Russell Vogt, former OMB director under Trump, and talk about this insanity. I'm Larry Kudlow. I'm trying to save America. I love this country. That's the reason we must kill the bill. All right? Please stick around, folks. Everybody, stick around. Live stream us. WABCRadio.com, LarryKudlowShow.com, throughout the country, around the world, throughout the solar system. We'll be right back. Saving America, killing the bill.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We bring in my great friend and former Trump colleague, Russ Vogt. Russ was the OMB director. He's president now of the Center for Renewing America. Russ, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Always my pleasure, Larry.
And how is the brilliant and beautiful Mary Vogt?
She is doing wonderful. She is out trying to save this country as we speak, and that is nothing new.
Yeah, no, I know. It's good. We need her. So, Russ, I want to save America and kill this bill, the so-called Build Back Smaller, with big taxes and high spending. For openers, I know you followed this. You were on the TV show last night talking about some of it. We have a little more time here. What do you make of this, okay? You're looking at it. You're seeing who the players are. Joe Manchin's going to break my heart if he goes through with this because he was so good to kill the $5 trillion original bill, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of this, Russ?
Mine as well, Larry, in the sense of hoping that Joe Manchin stays strong. I mean, there had always been this possibility because he had put out, you know, that even in the midst of these inflation numbers going up, that he would accept a bill in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion. Now, that had been a level that he set kind of as a negotiating premise, unconnected to real world activities in the economy that has worsened. And one of the great things about Joe Manchin thus far is that he, unlike most politicians, has allowed his bottom lines to be adjusted by a real world market. But we have a problem in that right now it does seem that they are making progress towards a deal in the neighborhood of $1 trillion that would be funded with tax increases on small businesses in trying to, you know, quote those that are kind of limited liability corporations, that we know them as small businesses, by raising their Medicare tax. When they raise the Medicare tax, that's just another form of taxation. That's not some kind of special tax that doesn't hurt the economy, and it doesn't necessarily go to Medicare either. They are working on the kind of the Medicare price control portion of this that would be go far, much further than you and I were comfortable with in the Trump administration, and actually get into the notion of negotiating prices in a way that would completely hurt our pharmaceutical industry. And then there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and they're not close, but they are making seeming progress, and there is a possibility that this could be a bill that's considered during the month of August or month of July before they recess for August. And so we've got to really be diligent in saving America and killing this new version of the bill.
Russ, you know, go back a few months when the so-called slimmed down version was, I think, around $2 trillion. But when people looked at it, including the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, they realized that it was a phony scoring because they had, you know, one-time or one-year or one-to-two-year spending plans that really, once they were in, would be permanent over 10 years. And so the CBO came out and says, no, it actually would be $5 trillion, and it would not be paid for. God forbid any of that happened. But the point is, I don't have enough information But I'm just worried that even $1 trillion, because Manchin has said he could accept $1 trillion, but it might be a phony $1 trillion. They got a lot of they got these crazy, right, renewable tax credits, which drains revenues, as you well know. And, you know, all these, they got a lot of spending subsidies. As I said, they got Obamacare in there. They got Medicaid in there. Lord knows what they have. You know, this could be much bigger over 10 years than they're letting on.
I think you can take that to the bank. I mean, that's the part they haven't shown Joe Manchin, seemingly from the press reports and some of our internal conversations with the Senate. They've shown him the part of how they might raise revenues, and he seems to be interested in that. But they have not shown, and he is sensitive on the gimmicks. He has walked the deal on that notion alone. But you are entirely right. The earlier versions would have artificial sunsets on the spending portion. And of course, they never have artificial sunsets with regard to the revenue and the tax increases that cripple the economy. So I do believe that there is much to be done, and our ability to defeat this is strong. Joe Manchin does seem to be someone that says, notwithstanding what I might have said in one context, I'm not going to be bullied into that when economic numbers continue to come out on inflation, on growth, and I think we're going to have more bad news on both of those. That has seemingly dictated his decisions. And, you know, I'm trying to be hopeful about this. You know, he's a member of the Democratic Party. It's very hard when your party is making something a priority not to talk to people and not to negotiate. But I think we've got a real significant opportunity to kill this bill, as we have done for the last year and a half.
Yeah, by the by, and I think you were part of this, we're resurrecting the America First Policy Institute Save America Coalition. We've already started conference calls. We're already running radio ads in West Virginia. I think we'll do more. We'll probably go on TV to do it. And we got about 100 groups in that coalition, and it worked pretty well. Steve Moore really was the quarterback. In some ways, I was the spokesperson. But we had a lot of strong people in that coalition from conservative groups that you know well. So we're working on that. You know, Russ, go back. Tell me about this. They're going to raise taxes. By the way, they're going to raise taxes on major corporations. So they want a 15% minimum tax on a book value basis, you know, which means no deductions, you know, not an IRS tax basis, book value, which some people have looked at and said that would effectively raise the top rate that the Trump administration brought from 35 to 21. It would effectively raise it to 28 or 30% because they're going to take out the deductions and the credits. Then they're going to use that money plus the investment tax on small business pass-through. And somehow they're saying $200 billion will go to Medicare. Now, I don't, you know, you mentioned it. We talked a bit last night on the TV show. How are they going to do this? How do we know it's going to go to Medicare? It's going to go to general revenues. The hospital fund has always been done by payroll taxes, which goes right in. How do you designate? Do you earmark? How do you write that up?
Yeah, this is kind of something that if you're in the business world and you come into government, you think it's working as if you have different savings and checking accounts. But that's not the way it works in the federal government. The way these trust funds work in the government is that they're notional. So money comes in through taxes, and certain revenue generators are credited to a trust fund. But it's not like this trust fund exists in like a 401k and earns money and investment, and somehow it's hard to take money out of it. That's not the way it works. That money sits in the general revenue. And it is spent out as it comes in. And so to the extent that we are not adjusting the real cost of the Medicare program in a fundamental way that would preserve it, all you're really doing is creating more money there to improve your deficits while you spend out the money on, you know, woke and weaponized government elsewhere. So this notion that this is going to extend the trust fund, yeah, on a paper basis, but in a real sense, not really.
Yep. Yep. And the reconciliation referee or whatever her name is, she might not even buy it. I mean, they're trying to sell it, you know, to save Medicare, which is a kind of, you know, apple pie and motherhood issue. Yeah, let's save Medicare. But I mean, I think that's a fraud. I mean, I just think that's a phony patina for political reasons. They could spend this tax money on any damn thing they want. They could get around to putting some of it into Medicare if there's an emergency in the next 4 or 5 years, sure. But that money is, you know, fungible. It goes into general revenues. It's fun. It's just money.
If that money's coming in right now, it's going to be spent out right now, and then they're going to make a notional check in the trust fund ledger that says it's owed to Medicare, and that's going to have to be paid back. But nothing has really changed in a fundamental, real sense that we all live in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, this is what they'll do is more deficit spending. That's what they're going to do. Now, Joe Manchin says it has to be paid for, and he always insisted about pay-fors, but then he said, well, we have to pay for half of it. All of a sudden, it went to half. And I go back to these investment tax credits for renewables. I mean, first of all, the original bill back in March of 2021 had a lot of money, you know, for climate change, renewables, all this Green New Deal stuff. Then the infrastructure bill, more than half of that bill was aimed again at the Green New Deal renewables. And this thing, they're going to do it again as much as they can get, and it won't be paid for. I mean, I don't want any of it, don't get me wrong. But if it comes, it won't be paid for. That's why I'm so puzzled by Manchin playing along. Now, you said an important thing. Joe meets with him in the caucus and stuff. He does weigh in on some things, but the context may not be what the left wants it to be. Maybe that's going on now, but I don't know. I see, you know, more deficit spending. I don't see pay-fors.
I don't either, and I don't think they're going to materialize. And in Washington, we haven't had real pay-fors in a long time. They tend to be accounting gimmicks and offsets that are already current law, and you're just extending those into the future. So we'll see. I don't believe it. My hope is that he pulls up from the brink and realizes not just that this does nothing for his financial goals of the economy and keeping it healthy or getting it healthier, but that he realizes that to the extent that they're doing these renewable subsidies and any aspect of the climate change agenda, it is a direct threat to the center of gravity of oil and gas exploration, which is the lifeblood of our economy, and that should go. He may have some small victory in what they are not able to put in this, and he can claim credit for that. But that's not going to help 10 years down the road when they have created all the subsidies that then dictate future mandates that we know they want to put in place.
Is there a state in the union more dependent on coal and, by the way, natural gas than West Virginia? I mean, what's he thinking? Yeah.
I know. I mean, that's the disconnect that, you know, that we all look at and say, on what planet would you consider to go down this path? And, you know, we got to hope that the devil's in the details and the details scare them off.
So, Russ, you're working on a balanced budget plan. Can you give us a couple of thoughts on that?
Sure. You know, this is a joint project that you and I are working on, and we're going to have a big coalition on it. And you and I could probably do this in a long weekend, but the state of our economy is such that, you know, the Biden administration continues to put us in a hole. So it's going to be hard. But, you know, we're putting together as a plan to balance in 10 and to really focus and make this a budget that could actually get done, not because it's informed with the way that the American people would balance their books, which would be to go and get rid of the discretionary budget first. That is, I call it woke and weaponized government. It's, you know, the American people know that when this isn't just the Department of Education that's educating their kids, it's educating with CRT-infused cultural Marxism. Mm-hmm. This is an environmental agency, EPA, that's not really just making sure we have clean rivers and clean lakes and clean air, but that is actually criminalizing landowners for building ponds on their ranch in violation of the waters of the United States. So it's weaponized. And so we want to go at that with a reckless abandon, and we want to have the types of policies that get people back in the workforce so that they had experienced the dignity of work and they're getting off the sidelines. And we believe that as we head in that direction, we will really be able to balance the budget and do it in a way that the political class, particularly if it's a Republican majorities and a future Republican administration, can do it without having to go at with reckless abandon some of the earned entitlement commitments that have been made to beneficiaries. Now, we're going to have to touch mandatory spending, and you know we did that in the Trump administration. But my hope is that we will be able to have a trajectory of balance like we did in the Trump administration, build off of those works while also being cognizant of the fact that seniors have been told that they needed to come with, when there were surpluses in these trust funds, that they were going to be the ones that both funded all of this government. And then when there was no more money left, they were also going to be the first on the chopping block. And I think that is a something that the D.C. political class has not come to recognize that President Trump did. And we're going to try to be honor the sentiment of that notion as we kind of construct this, given where we are in the economy.
Russ, last one. Will there be room to make the Trump tax cuts permanent so it's a growth budget?
We have to. I mean, we have to. There's no – you can't balance the budget without, you know, 3-4% growth. It's just not possible. And so you've got to extend the tax cuts because they're the foundation of the economic growth that's necessary. And so growth won't get us all the way, but we can't get there without growth, nor would we want to, because that's real people's lives and their ability to put food on their family table.
Terrific stuff. Terrific stuff. Russ Vogt, President, Center for Renewing America, former OMB director, great friend. Thank you, Russ. We'll talk soon.
Thanks.
I appreciate
Thanks.
It very much. Folks, you heard it. And we could have a Republican balanced budget plan. And if Kevin McCarthy wins the House and if Mitch McConnell gets the Senate back, they can start working on it. Probably need the White House in 24 to get it all done, but they can start. And they sure can stop the bad stuff. That's the key. Stop the bad stuff. But in the first goal, save America, kill this bill. Make it real simple. I'm Larry Kudlow. Up next, by the way, on the other side of the break, is David Bernhard, former Interior Secretary. He's going to talk about the mess that Biden has created with fossil fuels and power and high-priced gasoline.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. We're going to turn our attention to the energy crisis in the United States. I mean, here's a piece of good news. Gasoline prices are now down to $4.70. The peak was $5. That's nationwide. There's plenty of states in the country with much higher gasoline prices, but we are in trouble. We are also spending our strategic petroleum reserves, which should be reserved for energy security and national security. Biden is using it to bring down prices because he hates fossil fuels, wants to end fossil fuels, so he's using this. So 40% of that SPRO, 40% will have been depleted. And it really hasn't done much for prices. That's the point. When this thing started, $78.50 oil, oil still over 100, and gas prices were $3.40 when it started back in late 2021. And as I say, it's $4.70, down from the high, but still very high. So that ain't worked. It's all it's done is weakened our national security. And in general, the attack on fossil fuels is doing great harm to our economy. So we bring in David Bernhard, He was a former Secretary of the Interior, and he is now working with the America First Policy Institute. David, thank you for doing this. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
We're going to spend the whole half hour together, if you can. This is a lot. There's so much to talk about. Let me begin with your successor, former House member Deb Haaland, over in the Interior Department. The leasing season, or the leasing decision season, is among us. And the way I read it is, first of all, there could be no new leases at all. If there are any leases, there'll be a small amount, way below the Trump baseline. No offshore in the Atlantic, no offshore in the Pacific, maybe something in the Gulf of Mexico, maybe something in Alaska, although they've already turned against Alaska. Anyway, you used to make these decisions at the Interior Department. What do you make of what these decisions look like now under Ms. Haaland and President Biden?
Well, as normal, you are spot on with your facts. I mean, here's the reality. You know, from my perspective, the Biden administration's hostility towards American-produced oil and gas really seems to have no bounds. And I'm convinced that they simply do not see the benefit of American production for the American consumer, for the American economy, for our national security, and even for the global environment. And what they have done with this plan is the Friday before the 4th of July, for the first time ever, they missed the deadline to get a plan out before the old plan expired. So the old plan expired. They rolled out this proposal, and as you said, they took a large swath all of the Atlantic, all of the Pacific, and said no leasing there. And then they said maybe there'd be leasing in the Gulf of Mexico. And so they laid out a proposed schedule, but they were very, very clear that they may not proceed with that proposed leasing schedule. And that is really an unprecedented statement. And, you know, my initial view of it is simply that they looked at where the energy prices were, and their reaction was to essentially punt. They didn't want to make the hard decision of saying, hey, there's definitively not going to be leasing. And so they put out this possibility to kind of assuage both sides. And, you know, they did that in the context. You said, you know, gas is down a little bit at 470 today. But to put that in context, you know, when the economy was roaring in 2019, the average price of gasoline this time in 19 would have been about $2.80. Mm. So it's still very, very high. And so they're trying to be sensitive to it. But I think it comes down to this decision and a decision on the Permian regarding a potential examination of non-attainment. I think those actual decisions highlight the reality that the Biden administration has placed activists, climate activists, in many of these political appointment jobs, and they're driving one direction, and that direction is fundamental hostility to American-produced energy, and that's just their policy. You know, they have to have a few rhetoric statements every once in a while. They have to find ways to punt, but in this particular case with this leasing program, they did not want to make a decision to say no, but they certainly didn't want to take no off the table at this time.
You know, I'm reading your great interview with Fox Business website. Former top Trump official rips Biden administration's recent oil drilling proposal, reducing lease sales. And you coined a great phrase, climate activism beats energy security. I mean, that's really what's going on here. And David, I would just add to that, to me, energy security has a lot to do with national security.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, maybe you can talk about your thought process, because You've made it in very stark, clear, simple terms what the issue is. Radical climate activism beats energy security, beats national security, and the Bidens don't seem to care, right? They're gimmicks. They're taking 40%, depleting 40% of our SPRO, which is there for national security purposes. They don't care about that. They're just trying to manipulate prices. And as you've said, they don't care about new leases. And I'd only add to that, David, they're not given any permits anyway, right? There are no permits for drilling. There's no permits for pipelining. There's no permits for refinery. They don't care.
You've heard that all week on your show from your guests, and that is their reality. And, you know, the real harm here at the end of the day is to, first off, the American consumer who is harmed by these policies right out of the gate, and that's obvious to everyone. But it's also tremendously harmful to these local communities in areas like Louisiana that, you know, they are dependent on these economic activities. And what you're doing with not leasing and not issuing permits is simply not letting that economic activity thrive. And then when you look at the world, if you look at the world market, and if you look at the Energy Information Administration today, what they say about the future is for the next 2 years, they think world production is going to be flat. And where do they see growth? They see growth in the Permian, primarily driving world production. Otherwise, world production is flat. And then at the same time, what do we have? We have the Environmental Protection Agency beginning to focus like a laser on the Permian all at the same time. It makes absolutely no sense. And you were in the White House and you got to see the transformative benefit President Trump had in negotiating LNG deals, enhancing American security and enhancing the American economy. And that was a very powerful a national security and foreign policy tool to use. And the notion that we'd be trying to move backwards just makes absolutely no sense on any policy level.
This is one of Trump's greatest achievements. Open the spigots. That was his point. But he saw it as, you know, domestic enhancement for the economy, but he also saw it as national security. You know, you and I heard him so many times essentially begging these Europeans to realize just how dependent they are on Russia, begging them to open up facilities to take our LNG exports. You know, Merkel, right? Merkel of Germany said, absolutely, yeah, we will. She started it. And then the minute the 2020 election was over, she killed it. Okay. And other things, pipelines that we wanted to run up through. Anyway, I'm going to take a break, David, and I want you to please stay with me and come back. I want to talk about your Permian Basin concerns. This is the EPA ozone regulations. I don't think they have the authority to do it. Maybe the Supreme Court decision would hopefully stop that. I had Governor Abbott of Texas on this week, and he said he's going to take local state action to protect the Permian. According to some, the Permian produces 43% of our oil. 43%.
That's exactly right. It's 43% of daily production. You got that spot on, Larry.
So the EPA wants to close that down. Okay. It's unimaginable. I mean, you could be talking about 15 million jobs. It'll destroy Texas, for heaven's sakes.
Pretty incredible.
I just don't believe it. Anyway, we'll come back, take a quick break, come back, talk some more about the EPA authority to ozone. And what is the impact of this Supreme Court decision, West Virginia versus EPA? I think it pinned EPA's ears back, but I want to hear you talk about that too. So, folks, we got Dave Bernhardt, former Interior Secretary. He's now helping out the America First Policy Institute. I'm Larry Kudlow. Save America. Kill the bill. Save America. Shackle the EPA. I could go on forever, but I got a commercial break. We'll be right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are talking with David Bernhardt, the distinguished former Secretary of the Interior during the Trump years. presently helping out with the America First Policy Institute, and an old friend. The Biden's attack on fossil fuels, which, by the way, is the Bidens are attacking all of business and industry. This regulatory socialism that they're engaged in, central planning coming from Washington and the unelected bureaucrats. But we are focusing on energy because that's been the worst part. David Bernhardt, walk me through. Here's the EPA is going after new, tough restrictions on ozone. They're going to use ozone. The Obama Clean Power Plant was sort of, that was blown up by the Supreme Court decision. That's good. But they're trying to now use tight ozone standards to indirectly regulate carbon from fossil fuels. And they're going right after the Permian Basin, as you noted before the break. Now, can this be stopped? Greg Abbott, Governor Abbott, who's an old friend, a smart guy, he told me on TV the other night he can stop it using state laws. And the Supreme Court decision is essentially saying without congressional laws, the EPA has to give way to state laws. And there aren't any congressional laws, and they're not going to get any congressional laws through to deal with this. But what happens with ozone and the Permian? Can it be stopped?
Well, I think you have to start with one of the, you know, the reasons the Permian has thrived is, you know, first, great geology, right? That was critical. But also, the Permian is largely state-regulated. It's private land. It has a very stable regulatory regime. And then now you have the EPA and the activists at EPA saying, look, we're going to go after this like a laser, focused on whether or not they're obtaining the appropriate ozone requirements. And in doing that, they do have authority. The state has authority to push back, and the state will. The real challenge here, I think, is that it creates a great deal of hostility and uncertainty, which is really the point of efforts like this. At the end of the day, they drive investment away. They drive, investors who don't want to be in the business of fighting City Hall when making their investment. And that's happening across the energy sector because of the hostility that that the administration has. And we've seen typically when you have prices rising like this, you would see additional investments in efforts for production, and those have not been nearly as high. Now, the true consequence of this ozone effort is it could have a tremendous impact on individual rigs and rig counts out there, and that, you know, would further frustrate additional production. And so that is the real challenge. Abbott has arguments, and Abbott has some strength. Now, whether the EPA decision, EPA versus West Virginia, is the decision that would push back on this or not, remains to be seen. But it very well may, because Justice Roberts was very, very clear in laying out why the Supreme Court took the action it did in rejecting the radical Clean Power program. And he said essentially this, that we are addressing a particular and recurring problem. And what was that problem that they're addressing? The particular and recurring problem they're addressing is federal agencies asserting highly consequential power beyond what Congress could reasonably be understood to have granted. And that's what they were going after. They had seen agency after agency doing this, and he lays out the standard when there's a agency asserting highly consequential power beyond what Congress could reasonably be understood to have granted, we're not going to uphold that action. And, in the case of the Clean Power Plan, they had a law that was nearly 50 years old, and it had never been interpreted the way the Obama administration proposed to interpret it. Congress had rejected climate change legislation, and this had an enormous impact on the economy. Now, fast forward to the Permian, 43% of daily production, depending on how dramatic they want to be, that could be tremendously consequential. And so there may be something here, but there's certainly what Roberts has done with this case is laid out very clearly, not only to EPA, but to all federal agencies. Look, what you, agency, don't be asserting a highly consequential power beyond what we think Congress could have been reasonably understood to have granted. And that is a real shot across the bow to the agencies to be judicious with their actions and authority. Now, I have no faith that the Biden administration will get that message. But the second message was to the lower courts. You need to be sorting this out.
Right.
Don't allow this peculiar and recurring problem to continue. And it's also a warning to Congress that, hey, you need to write clear statutes and don't just punt to agencies when a problem comes up and think they can fix it. Now, the overall result of that case, as you know, is a great result for democracy because it says the power for highly consequential decisions rest with the elected representatives of America. And that means that the American people can hold those people accountable where they can't hold a bureaucrat accountable.
Yeah, that's a great rundown, by the way. Thank you for that. You know, John Roberts has always been very good on economic regulation. I may not agree with
Absolutely.
Him on other things, but that's, I've known him a good many years, and he's always been good on that. One of the points you just made, which I think is key and probably will determine the fate of the Permian, and it might also determine the fate of the Marcellus, right, the Bakken, all these big oil reservoirs, is the lower courts, as you described. Now, the state officials will act in their own best interest. So Greg Abbott, for example, in Texas, you know, he and his attorney general will do whatever it takes to keep the Permian open. I mean, he was quite clear about that.
That's right.
He's willing to fight.
That's right.
And that's his nature. I mean, he's a very good governor. But your point about the lower courts may be absolutely crucial, David.
Absolutely. And it may take the courts, you know, a few times to get it right, to be honest mm-hmm. with you, as they work these back. But what we do know with this Roberts decision, this was a 6-3 decision. And I think that all six of those members for this decision are going to be very steadfast in this issue. And that is significant for the regulatory, reining in the regulatory overreach that has consistently occurred in this administration. And it really means I'm very hopeful of the decision because I think it means greater accountability. And it means that legislators may have to deal with the issues of the day and decide them and reach compromise. And remember, if we're going to impose, if the American people are going to have imposed on them a highly consequential decision, that compromise of legislating should be where that policy is reconciled. And that is the right place for it.
You know, one quick point, we're run out of time, but the Baker Hughes rig count, David, you know, it has not recovered despite record prices. So that's to your point. David Bernhardt, former Interior Secretary, helping out with the America First Policy Institute. Can't thank you enough, David Bernhardt. We will talk soon. Folks, please stick around. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to talk about China and stopping China and stopping and keeping the Trump tariffs in China with Gordon Chang on the other side of this break.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I am Larry Kudlow, and I want to turn our attention to China and the threat that the Biden administration is going to remove the Trump tariffs that were put in place on China to, to get the phase one trade deal, but also to try to keep it as insurance. We don't know whether that thing has been properly implemented or not. And there are some other issues here, too. So we bring in Gordon Chang, who lived and worked in Asia for 20 years, a longtime commentator, author. His recent book, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. And Gordon, welcome to the show. And, you know, that tech war you write about, that is precisely the heart of the Trump actions to stop China from intellectual property theft. And just as important, we talked about this on the TV show the other night when you were on, the forced transfer of technology. We cannot, I mean, technology innovation is the heart of the American economy in many ways, and we can't let China steal it. And I don't understand why the Bidens want to give China anything with respect to pulling back on tariffs. I didn't understand the solar panel decision, and I don't know whether how big this pullback will be. The papers are saying $10 billion, but it could be more. You are right about this, and what is to be done? What is the threat here?
The threat here, Larry, is exactly as you mentioned, and that is the theft of America's future. America has a strong society. It has a strong military. It has a great economy because of American innovation, but China's been stealing it. And many people forget, not you, but many people forget that President Trump imposed the tariffs under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 as a remedy for the theft of intellectual property. We don't know exactly how much China's been stealing, but John Ratcliffe, when he was Director of National Intelligence, estimated at about $500 billion a year. Mm. Some people in industry say more, some say less, but we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars annually.
Trump himself put out a very strong statement opposing the removal of these tariffs for any number of reasons. Here's just a thought. First of all, economists have said the tariffs had no impact on inflation. Pretty much outside the White House, nobody buys the argument that it'll help lower inflation by removing the tariffs. So put that aside. My question has always been here, why do we want to give or reward China for anything right now? They have been hostile. I want to talk about spying raised by FBI Director Wray. Even things like TikTok, which is basically scooping up all this personal information, goes right back to the Chinese Communist Party. What in the world can Biden be thinking here? And by the by, you know, if you in a battle, you know, if you make a concession to one side, you expect the other side to come back and give you something. China's not going to give us anything.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That's not the way the Chinese operate.
Right.
We're Americans, and so we operate under the assumption that if we're nice to somebody, they'll be nice to us.
Yeah.
Chinese don't think that way, especially Chinese communists. Their view is we will do something, but only if we're forced to. And that really means that the Biden administration shouldn't be giving gifts to China. It should be imposing costs. If they impose costs, we might get something in return. And that is something that President Trump understood. He broke five decades of failed engagement policy, and he said, look, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm imposing costs on China. And guess what? China started to come around. Now, I think that they didn't come around far enough. I think President Trump should have been tougher. But the point is, Trump understood the way the Chinese think. Biden doesn't.
Yeah, you know, that's a Lighthizer. Bob says that really the Trump policy rang the bell on China as our adversary, not as our friend, not as some collegiate, you know, capitalist country working with us. He rang the bell on the China threat. I mean, in some sense, that was his overriding victory.
Yes, and right now we have a president who doesn't call China an adversary. He doesn't even use the term that China uses for us, which is enemy, by the way. All that Biden will say is that we're in competition with China. We're not, Larry, because the Chinese don't believe in the existing liberal international order, as Brian Deese, your successor, has said. what China believes is that they should rule the world, and they should also rule the near parts of the solar system, because they believe that mm-hmm. Mars and Moon should be part of the People's Republic of China. Mm-hmm. That's absurd, but that's the way they think. So we're not competing with these guys. We are in a fight with these guys over what the shape of the world will look like.
You know, your bride, who I think is tougher on this than either of us, you know, she pulled me aside the other night at that Committee to Unleash Prosperity dinner. And she makes the point, and it's really, it is China that broke the liberal world order, at least with respect to trading and other things. It was China who broke that. It wasn't us. It was them. We're just trying to retaliate or, you know, somehow make it easier. They're the ones. And we let them in the World Trade Organization, and they proceeded to break every trading law under the sun.
Yes, and the one that you pointed out just now is really important because we don't talk about it anymore, and that is forced technology transfer,
right,
which, by the way, is a violation of World Trade Organization rules. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we did not complain about it, and that's up to us. I mean, We've got to make sure that we enforce those rules. But the point is, China has violated these rules, and they violated more than just the forced technology rule. They violated just about all of their commitments.
Yes. So FBI Director Christopher Wray is trying to warn. I'm looking at an article. It's actually the AP, Associated Press. American-British leaders raise fresh alarms about Chinese espionage. Now, this is not exactly a new issue, but, you know, here's Chris Wray doing this, reaffirming concerns in denouncing economic espionage and hacking operations by China, as well as the Chinese government's effort to stifle dissent abroad. So they are spying everywhere, and that's why I also bring in this collateral issue, Gordon Chang, because, you know, the TikTok issue, all right? You know, kajillions of people are on TikTok. They get the individual information from all these users. That information goes to Beijing. That information goes to the Chinese Communist Party. Why haven't we booted them out of here?
We haven't booted them out of here because Biden is president. President Trump tried to do one thing in his last year, and that was to force a sale of TikTok to an American party, which ended up being Oracle. But he also issued an executive order to ban TikTok and WeChat, which is a different type of Chinese app. Biden, though, one of the first things he did, his Justice Department went to, I think it was the Ninth Circuit, but he went to one of the circuit courts, and he actually withdrew the case of trying to ban TikTok and WeChat. And we know that TikTok has repeatedly lied to the American public about its assurances that data was kept in the United States. We know that from the June 17th BuzzFeed reporting that over a period of 5 months, starting in September of last year, that there were audio recordings of meetings where American employees of TikTok said they couldn't access the data, and the people who could access the data, they were in China.
Mm. Yes, right. Now, Robert O'Brien, National Security Advisor, makes this point over and over again. These companies are instrumentalities of the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party has set rules, and we know, it's been very clear, that they have the authority to force these companies to report information to them. And if you don't, you go to jail. I mean, and so we are not doing anything about that. And we should.
As we should. There are two reasons why all of these companies in China, including TikTok's parent, ByteDance, are under a compulsion to spy. First of all, there's the Communist Party's top-down system where nobody is allowed to disobey the Communist Party. But the party, incredibly, has even put this into law. China's 2017 National Intelligence Law, Articles 7 and 14, require every Chinese national, every Chinese entity to spy if Beijing demands. Mm. And that means TikTok is under a compulsion to spy on Americans.
Yep. Gordon Chang, last 30, 40 seconds here. China wants to go to the moon. They want to take over the moon. What do you make of that?
That's clear. China says it doesn't want to, but in 2018, the head of China's lunar exploration program talked about denying the moon to other countries, and he also talked about this in connection with Mars. So they believe that the moon and Mars should be part of the People's Republic of China.
Isn't that something? I mean, just think about that. I mean, I think that's absolutely incredible. Anyway, Gordon Chang, thanks very much for the rundown. Best regards to your wife, and we will speak soon. Appreciate it very much. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to bring in John Hartley, distinguished economist with the Hoover Institution, and he's going to talk about why the Fed is going to create a recession, and it may be a deep recession. This is part of the problem. Save America, kill the bill. And now we're in a position where the Federal Reserve is going to conquer inflation and they're going to rip it right through this economy. You hate to see it, but it looks like it's going to happen. So stick around. John Hartley, next up. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Yes, I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure to be with you, everybody. By the way, you want to live stream us, Internet, WABCRadio.com or LarryKudlowShow.com. We got a pretty big group on the live stream internet stuff across the country and around the world and throughout the solar system. We have to worry about the solar system, don't we? As Gordon Chang described, the Chinese want to take the moon and Mars. Anyway, just saying, that's something to beware of. So let's talk to John Hartley, an old friend. He's with the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He's a research associate at the Distinguished Hoover Institute out at Stanford on the West Coast. John Hartley, welcome. I'm looking at your piece from National Review Online, The Inevitable Fed-Induced Recession. All right? So what goes up has to come down. So the money supply, M2, I'll use M2, explodes up for 18 months as the Fed bought the bonds issued by the Bidens. And also in 2020 because of the pandemic stuff, they bought them. They bought about 62%, and the money supply exploded, and that has led to the big inflation. And you're saying it's inevitable now that the Fed is going to check inflation, and that's going to drive us into a recession. First of all, do I have your thesis right? And second of all, why does this always have to happen? Why?
Yeah, well, thanks, Larry, for having me. I think that basically the core of the thesis, I think, you know, we had this new non-farm payrolls number that came out yesterday. You know, it was very robust, and, you know, we've got these, the labor market that's pretty robust and the unemployment rate that's around 3.6%. But, and, you know, that's leading some people to say, you know, that there's no recession and soft landing. But, you know, my counter to that narrative is that I think, you know, history says otherwise, and that we're still in the early innings of this, I think, much longer inflation-beating ball game. I know you're a big Aaron Judge fan like I am. But, you know, I think, you know, we've seen, you know, first quarter GDP, we had a negative number, you know, negative 1.6. You know, the Atlanta Fed now cast is negative 1.2. And, you know, maybe we're seeing a bit of a productivity slowdown for now, you know, in that there's less output, you know, per worker hour, even though, you know, the labor market seems a bit robust. But, you know, again, you know, we're in the early stages, early innings of this ball game. You know, I think core inflation, you know, it's at 6%. Headline CPI is still at 8.5%. And even though, you know, things like WTI are now falling below $100 a barrel, I think, you know, we're going to need a lot more than that to bring, you know, core CPI back down to the Fed's long-term 2% target. And, you know, that's going to require some reductions in the price of housing. And so, you know, it's important to remember, you know, housing makes up about a third of CPI and even almost about 40% of core CPI. And so I think if you look at history, the 1950s, the 1960s, the early 80s, the early 90s recession, these were all recessions that were Fed-induced. Yeah, you know, the Fed was trying to fight inflation of that day. And, you know, thankfully, you know, we've had this inflation targeting regime over the past 30 years. But I think what's unfortunately happened is, you know, we've had this transitory narrative all the stimulus, you know, these supply side sort of supply chain disruptions that have gotten us away from this 2% target. We can sort of debate, you know, whether the Fed should have, you know, how much earlier should the Fed have started raising rates. But I think there's a lot more rate hikes to come.
Yep.
And the history sort of says that, you know, any time the Fed needs to fight inflation like this, you know, it's followed by a recession.
You know, John, apart from the excessive federal spending, which the Fed monetized, I think, you know, you're describing an old problem in monetary policy, an old, old problem, and it's this stop and go. You know, now, we beat it. As you say, we had for three decades clear 2% target for price stability, and most of the Fed chairs and the FOMC, you know, they said price stability is the cornerstone of economic growth. And that theory was thrown out by this Fed, by the Jay Powell Fed. And so they slammed down the accelerator. Money supply soars, right? Then they say, no, there's no inflation problem. And then what inflation there is because of supply shortages or, you know, Biden blames Vladimir Putin. But the reality is all prices are rising. The indexes are rising. And now the Fed is going to – they are crunching down the money supplies, you probably know. I mean, the thing – year-to-year money, John, I think, peaked in late 2020, early 21, some such – at about 27%, and now it's down to about 6 or 7% year on year, and I think the last 3 months it's been flat. So the stop-and-go theory that you're writing about, we're in the stop period, and it's going to crash the economy. And as you also note, and this is so important, guess who gets hurt the most? The least among us. The least among us, okay? The middle class, yes, but it's the lower middle class and it's the poverty class. They are going to get slaughtered as the Fed adjusts for its prior mistake.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think what's a bit unfortunate, too, about this inflationary scenario that we're also seeing is that, you know, inflation also hurts the poor the most. You know, the poor, you know, they consume a much bigger fraction of their incomes. Gas makes up gas and food makes up a very disproportionate part of their consumption basket. But unfortunately, because inflation sort of gotten out of control and that we've veered away from this 2% target in the way we have, and we can, again, debate why that's happened, you know, the poor are paying for it sort of on both sides of it. At Free Opportunity Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, we've created these inflation inequality indices, and you can see that. You know, this is just using government data and breaking it up by income brackets. You can see that inflation rates are higher for, you know, those in lower income brackets. And so, unfortunately, what's going to happen now is that they've been paying, you know, a bigger part of their incomes, for gas and food and really bearing the brunt of inflation. And now they're going to also bear, I think, you know, what's going to be like the brunt of, you know, what's going to be, I think, a nasty recession. You know, they've in general, you know, greater likelihood of becoming unemployed and so forth. But I think it's really unfortunate. I think we really have to ask this question, you know, how did we get here? And I think this is, you know, partly what, you know, you're alluding to is that there was this transitory narrative, you know, which I think was, you know, a bit of a cover for, I think, you know, additional stimulus. You know, we were talking about Build Back Better and, you know, a few months ago, and that, you know, we didn't have to worry about inflation and and then we had things like ARP, and I think there's a healthy debate about what exactly was the cause of all this inflation to begin with. But, you know, the longer, you know, we let inflation get out of control, the more difficult and I think the more painful the recession ultimately will be that accompanies the required rate hikes to bring down inflation.
Well,
you know, I think
John Hartley, why did the Fed abandon the 2% target? It seems to me that they, you know, for three decades, we developed inflation price targeting. This was good. And they held to it. And Jay Powell abandoned it. And why did they do that? It's like the old saw, John. What were they thinking?
What were they thinking? And look how this is going to end badly.
It's a great question. I think you have to think about how broken our inflation forecasting has been over the past year or so. We had this long narrative that inflation was just simply going to be transitory. I don't think that these forecasts were coming out of any sort of econometric model, but I think in a way they were sort of created by this sort of narrative, this almost media narrative, that everybody disagreed. Well, you can chalk up everything to used cars or whatever the small sort of narrative was, and then over time things sort of started to bite, and it became more than just that. It became housing and many other sort of everyday goods and just the complete price basket. But I think you have to ask yourself, if, for example, say President Trump had won a second term and we saw this inflation spike in May of last year, just like we had, would the media have been promoting this sort of narrative that inflation is just transitory, because obviously, being a sort of political enemy, but in many ways promoting this transitory narrative, I think almost gave excuses not to raise rates sooner. I mean, imagine it, all the media course that would have blamed, President Trump in a second term for this inflation. I think perhaps the Fed would have been a bit more responsive.
Yes.
But I think I think we really need to take a look and ask ourselves, why did we get this inflation forecasting so wrong?
Yep.
And I think there really needs to be a serious hard look in terms of how we're thinking about inflation forecasting.
It's a very costly mistake is what it is. And maybe we'll learn a lesson, maybe we won't. Anyway, John Hartley, thank you ever so much. Folks, we're going to take a break. On the other side of the break, we're going to do some stock market work. But here's a big question. Is Elon Musk really pulling out of Twitter, or are there going to be more chapters in this saga? I am Larry Kudlow. Please stick around. We'll be right back.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great to be with you. We're going to do some stock market work in just a moment. I just want to remind, during the week, Monday through Friday, Fox Business Television, the name of the show is Kudlow, and it's 4 to 5 p.m. every day. And if you can't get there at 4, you can call up your favorite 9-year-old who will show you how to DVR it so you can see it at night when you get home. I don't want you to miss a thing. We have to save America and kill the bill and other things as well. Kill the EPA. And I won't use the word kill, but shall we just say stop the Biden big government socialism. Anyway, those are our themes. We have here Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist, Hightower Advisors, and Head of Investment Solutions, and Ken Polcari, Managing Partner at Case Capital Advisors and Chief Market Strategist at Slate Stone Wealth. So, kids, welcome back. And I want to talk about the stock market and commodities and interest rates, but we need to begin. Get ready, Stephanie. We need to begin with Elon Musk. Elon Musk. Is Elon Musk really pulling out of the Twitter deal, or is he going to force them to give him better numbers on these phony accounts, the bots and all this nonsense? I mean, I don't see, look, I make no bones about it. I'm a big fan of Elon Musk. I don't see how you can buy the thing, buy Twitter, and make a business plan unless you know what their user base really is. And I think Twitter hasn't done that. That's point number one. Point number two, I'm sure Elon wants a lower price. And point number three, I do believe, I have not spoken to him, but I believe he really wants to buy Twitter and make his free speech case, and that you can run social media companies on the basis of free speech and still make money. So, I mean, I think this is just one chapter in this saga. I mean, that's my take. I think he's going to be back, but for the moment, he's out. And I want to say, what do you guys think? Steph, what do you think he's
going to
do?
I think this is it's a circus, right? This is a very, very dangerous stock to own, number one, because it's not trading on fundamentals. Number two, I think he should have taken his time in terms of the offer and doing the due diligence like most bankers do, right? Most companies do when they're looking to buy another company. Sure, he wants a lower price because he doesn't know the data, and we don't know what he actually knows. That's number one. It's also lower because social media stocks have been in the toilet all year long, and they've been falling rapidly, right? So I understand why he wants a lower price, but I think the due diligence that he undertook was really very basic and very quick. Who knows how it plays out, but it is a circus, as I mentioned, and it's not trading on fundamentals. So if you own this stock or you buy this stock because of Elon Musk, that's a very risky play, in my opinion.
I thought, was Morgan Stanley his banker? Who was his banker?
Yeah, I think it was Morgan Stanley.
Why didn't they do what you just said they should have done?
Because you can't.
I mean, they're good bankers, Morgans, but why didn't they do it?
They're great bankers. They're great bankers. But you know what? It's like Elon Musk is Elon Musk. He's going to do what he wants to do. Unfortunately, this backfired in his face, and we'll see how it all turns out, though. I don't think he's done either, by the way.
Let me just jump in, because I agree with everything you've said, but I think you're right. Whether or not Morgan Stanley was the banker or whether or not he started, he started this whole thing on his own, and then he pulled people in. And to Stephanie's point, I think he just said, look, I want to do it. This is it. I don't want to hear anything about it. And he kind of pushed everybody back, probably against their better judgment, but they couldn't convince him to do otherwise, because look how fast it happened. And now he's sitting there complaining, well, they didn't tell me that. Well, honestly, you kind of forgave your right to do all that work because he was so impetuous, right? He wanted to do it so fast and make the point, and this is what he gets. I don't think he's going away. I think this is all part of the ploy because I think he's trying to get it a bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I think on Monday the stock's going to be trading. I don't know where it closed on Friday, but it'll be trading at 20 by Monday. But
he'll like that, right? That's what he wants.
Like that. Absolutely is what he wants.
Elon is a disruptor. Elon is the Donald Trump of, whatever, Silicon Valley, or he's in Texas now. He's a disruptor. Right. Elon is living proof of Joseph Schumpeter's gales of creative destruction. That's what Elon Musk is. I don't know. Stephanie's right. It's a circus, but it's pretty cool, Steph. You got to admit, the whole world is watching this deal. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, you look at the Fox, forget the Fox Business website. The Fox News website has this on top. I mean, that's usually reserved for other things. CNBC has it on top. Bloomberg has it on top. I mean, tragic assassination of Shinzo Abe is a major news story, but right with it is Elon Musk and Twitter. And you got to go, wait, really? But yeah, that's the deal. Whatever he does.
It's like you wake up and you go to Twitter to see what is the latest and greatest on the situation.
Right.
Do you guys have accounts on Twitter? Do you tweet?
Yes.
Kenny and I
tweet together. I mean, we tweet to each other, too.
Oh, that's great. That's great. You make a lovely couple. That's terrific.
I tweeted about this show this morning, inviting everyone to join us.
Oh, that is really good. By the way, I used to tweet. I tweeted for years, had a good bunch of followers. And then I did, when I went into the White House, I stopped for a number of reasons. But since I've come back to town, I have not tweeted. I haven't tweeted in 5 years, basically. As I grew weary, I'm obviously a political and economic conservative, and I would just grow weary of all these whack jobs attacking me and saying, weird, nasty thing. I mean, I had the followers defended me, but the attackers are so bad and so poisonous.
Right.
They
can do it because they do it behind closed doors, right? Because no one really knows whether they have a real name or a fake name, but they can do it because they're not actually doing it right to you, right? They're hidden behind the keyboard.
All right, we'll put that. I So Kenny Pocari thinks there'll be more chapters. Do you, Steph? More chapters in this saga?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. Look, I mean, Kenny's right. If it opens down, if that's 20, right? I mean, it's not actually even an expensive stock at this point, but you just don't know what the E is, right? You have no idea if they're even going to have an E. But if it opens down 20 to 20, I mean, then automatically he's got to make a stink on a lower price. It's just what is in the who signed what, right? Like we just don't know what he agreed to. So that's why it's so uncertain.
Right, but you saw the story today. The board is determined now to close this deal at the price at 54.20. Naturally, right? Mm-hmm. The stock has at 36.81 on Friday on yesterday. So if this thing opens in the 20s, which I think it very well could, if this story continues to build over today and tomorrow, you know, we could see it really collapse on Monday.
That board, that board is so full of it. I mean, they're so dumb. Anyway, who's going to buy Twitter if Elon doesn't buy it? Who wants it?
Nobody, because nobody's come up to challenge it.
Right. That's the interesting part. All through this, it's not like there's some bidding competition. I mean, Twitter is a dud, right? They ran it into the ground because they went far left, you know, censored conservative opinions, blah, 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 blah. And so the thing's collapsed. And if he doesn't buy it, he's the only safety net they have. You know, he's like a Greenspan put or something.
They couldn't monetize it. That's the whole problem, right? They had these enormous expenses, and they thought. Now, look, we can say all we want about Facebook, but Facebook figured out how to monetize. And by the way, they're going to figure out how to monetize Reels as well. That's their problem now, the TikTok competitor. But they'll figure it out. They have proven that investing heavily reaps reward, right? That you can figure out how to monetize what you have. Twitter never did. They never could. They spent They spent like crazy, and then you every quarter there will be a disappointment in one area or the other. Trust me, I owned it for a little bit of time, and I made money in it, thankfully, and I got out. But it's just they really do need Musk in there. They really do.
Yeah.
I know he's the only thing they got. Yeah. Look, it may go to 20, okay, but I'll say this: without Musk,
it could go to 10.
I was going to say the difference between 20 and zero will evaporate.
Well, look at Snap. Look at Snap, right? Mm. And and they're in a world of hurt right now because they too can't monetize. So, you know, this is an interesting sector, and it'll be an interesting case study in like 10 years.
I'm so happy to hear that. I mean, for me, all these socialist lefties, I'm glad they're in a world of hurt. I want them to hurt. They're lucky that they have Elon Musk, free market, libertarian, free. I mean, Elon Musk. It's not only does he want to buy Twitter for free speech reasons, he then declared that he was going to vote Republican in the elections. I mean, that was like for the mainstream media, that was the kiss of death. They put him on the enemies list. He voted for that Republican gal, the Hispanic gal on the border in Texas.
Right.
He voted for her.
What they did to her, by the way, the other day?
Yes, I know. It's just off. I'm only laughing because it's a theater of the absurd. But yes, you're right. I mean, that's what they do. But not you guys. You guys are okay. You're giving my show credibility. Please stick around. We have Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist at Hightower, Head of Investment Solutions, and Kenny Pocari, Managing Partner, Case Capital, and Chief Market Strategist, Slatestone Wealth. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll come back, and we will talk about stocks and commodities and interest rates. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back after this.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. So we're talking stocks with Stephanie Link and Kenny Pocari. Kenny, what's your market outlook right now?
So I think that we're in for this month is going to be a little bit of a bumpy, rough month. We'll get earnings start this week. I think earnings are going to start to come down. I think more importantly, the guidance going forward is going to be weaker than what the market expects. And so, therefore, I think as we move through this season, it's going to be bumpy. Now, that doesn't mean I think the market's going to collapse at all. I think we're going to find support at S&P 3600, which is down about, 200 points from where we are now. I guess where we close on Friday, 250 points. I think that's where it wants to find support. But I would caution people as we move into this earnings season to be prepared for numbers and guidance, I think is going to be weaker than what the expectation is.
Yeah, that's so this little I look at this. We've been through the last couple of weeks of what I consider to be a bear market rally. You may disagree with that and so forth. But
no, I don't. I think you're right.
The S&P is now down 18% year to date. So it's still hovering around the bear market level. This past week, let's see, the Dow was up 241. The S&P was up 74. The Nas had a really good week, up 507. Anyway, Stephanie Link, what's your market outlook?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's puts and takes. The highlights are clearly the jobs market, right? Jobs were strong on Friday, and we've now created 2.7 million jobs in the last 6 months. Wages are still very solid at 5.1%, and down from 5.3% from the last reading, which I don't know if you want to call that peak inflation. It's still high, but it's still good for the consumer. And commodities are coming down, and housing is cooling. So that to me, that maybe the inflation side of the equation is starting to at least peak. Hopefully, it's going to come down. But at the same time, you've got strong jobs. So everyone that tells me that we're in a recession, I have a very hard time reconciling that. The job market really is very jolt. We're actually still over 11 million, so there's still a lot of job openings. So to me, I think, you know, this is a hard environment. We're down a lot. I think we're discounting a lot of bad news. We have to wait and see what the Fed does. They're going to go to 75 in July. Do they go 75 in September and then maybe take the foot off the gas? Hopefully, but we don't know. That's your one wild card, and that's what makes it hard to get super, super bullish. But I'm not that bearish, given that we've already seen these declines, and we still have a solid economy.
The trouble is wages are rising, but the money is worth less because inflation is rising more. So you see in a big drop in real disposable income and real wages. And you're also seeing a big drop. Now, we'll get new numbers, obviously, for the month of June. We'll get those numbers in the next couple of weeks. But real retail sales, way down. And PCE, real PCE, is going to be very soft, maybe close to zero. So, Stephanie, I don't, just a tiny pushback. I know the payrolls were pretty good. With the prior revisions of the prior two months, it was 300,000, so that's a good number. But the household employment survey was off 350,000, and that thing is averaged. That's two of the last 3 months it's had big drops. So I'm not sure I understand this labor stuff at the moment.
It's definitely confusing, for
it
sure.
Really is.
But we got to get people back to work. You know, I mean, this is the whole thing. This is the whole reason why the Fed is doing what they're doing. I mean, we want to get people back to work. We have to get inflation down. We've got to slow the economy. We all know this, though. So if I'm looking at this from the economy, sure, a lot of puts and takes and a lot of unknowns. But from an investing point of view, I think we're discounting a heck of a lot of bad news. I really do. Especially when you say about retail sales, you know what? I totally understand that. But then I go and I look at, let's just say, the XLV, right? The XLY, rather, the consumer discretionary ETF. It's down 30% year to date.
Right.
Don't we know that
right.
the consumer is taking their foot off the gas, too?
Yeah,
right.
We know.
Right. That's been all the. But I got to ask you a question, Steph, or Larry, either one of you. The issue about getting people back to work, wages are rising. We've got 11 million jobs out there that are available. Why can't we get people back to work? Is it the fact that those jobs are much more technical? We're not educated enough to fill those jobs? Is that the reason that we can't get people to come back to work with higher wages and all these job openings?
I actually have heard that there's more people are starting their own companies, and they're not going back to corporate America, right? So that's number one. And then, of course, we know people that are just out of the labor force. They retired. They said, enough of this. And then of course, you still have that issue at whoever is taking care of the children at home. There's still a lot of unknown, right? So I think there's a whole bunch. But I agree with you. It is perplexing. 11 million job openings is a huge, huge number relative to the historical average. Yeah, I get it.
Especially when companies are paying higher wages and trying to pay bonuses to attract people.
I know. I've lost count how many times McDonald's has actually increased wages year to date. I think I lost count after four times, right? Yeah. I know.
Well, bear in mind on this, though, you've got part of the complexity here. The government is still paying out benefits mm-hmm. one way or another for not working. There's no work requirements in housing subsidies.
And I think that's the problem.
Welfare subsidies, food stamp subsidies. You know, I mean, I wish it weren't true because I think, you know, I think work is holy. And I think work is the fabric of the country. But you got a lot of people who have left the labor force. By the way, this number, the jobs number yesterday, 350,000 people left the workforce. That's a big number.
A big number.
And I acknowledge that the labor market is tight. No question about that. And I acknowledge the big number of unfilled jobs. But gee whiz, people are leaving. The other thing is, I'll throw this out. Jason Furman, who's pretty much a straight shooter, he's a very good economist, friend of mine. He's an Obama guy. He was a Clinton guy before that. He, along with Summers, has been yelling at the Bidens for all their spending causing inflation. But he has a little section in his report yesterday. A lot of people now are being mandated by their companies to go back to work in the office.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're not used to it, don't especially like it. Productivity is way down, and that's depressing the economy. Just think of that.
Well, Larry, think about what's happening in New York City alone. People don't want to take the subways anymore. It's filthy when you get down there. The poor guy from Goldman Sachs got shot on a Sunday morning because people down in the subway, you know, it's out of control. And so people that have been home, that have been productive from home, now don't want to be forced to come back to the city. Yet you have the city saying to the big companies, you've got to bring these people back because we're choking to death. We need these people to come back. So there's this yin-yang that's happening in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the corridors at Fox Media, people have come back. I mean, when I first started the show a year and a half ago or whatever it was, the building was empty. I always go to work, but I get tested a lot. So real quick, we just got a minute left. Stephanie, is there a particular investment you want to mention?
Well, I think this week it's going to be very interesting to see the banks. They're going to report earnings, and you know I am overweight them. They're very cheap. They're all down about anywhere from 16 to 25% year-to-date, and many of them trade at book value. We know capital markets are going to be weak. The offset is we do have higher interest rates, and banks actually make more money. So it's going to be interesting. I want to see how they trade.
I'm out of time. I'm out of time. I love both of you, Stephanie Link and Kenny Polcari. Wonderful stuff. Folks, after the break, money and politics, Liz Peek and Steve Moore. We're going to have some fun with that one, too. Please stick around.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, everybody. Money and politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, Steve Moore. Chief Economist of Freedom Works and Committee to Unleash Prosperity and the author of GovZilla. I got a couple things for you kids, but Liz, I got your column on Elon Musk. The key word here, the money sentence, my bet is on Musk. I love that. Now, we just talked about this with Ken Polcari and Stephanie Link, two very good market people, but you're saying my bet is on Musk. Let's see. The original offer was $52.20, $44 billion. So the stock closed in moonlight trading at $35.04, down 5%. As I was going online looking at their profile, Liz. I love this. Earnings per share on a trailing 12-month basis, zero. But 0.24, all right? I'll call that zero. And the price-earnings ratio on the same basis is 152. Now, I wouldn't want to buy that with those kinds of numbers, okay? That's point number one. Point number two, for my way of looking at life, I think Elon, this is just one chapter in a long, I don't think he's going to walk away. I think he's going to get it. I think the Twitter people have been lying through their teeth from day one. They know how bad it is. But if he doesn't buy it, who's going to buy it? You know, I think it was Stefan, and it might have been Pulcari. He said the stock's going to open at 20 on Monday. And my response to that is the difference between 20 and zero could evaporate very fast because I don't know who's going to buy this turkey.
Well, okay, so I agree. I mean, I think that the real question is how badly has Twitter manipulated their numbers? How dishonest have they been with shareholders, the SEC, and with Elon Musk? Because Elon Musk is not a fool. I mean, for him and his advisors and his law firm to basically charge Twitter with not being responsive to his demands, which, by the way, seemed to me particularly or completely reasonable demands. He wants to know basically how many average daily users are there, and if 10% or 20% of them are spam or bots or whatever you want to call them, the business is worth an awful lot less than Twitter's management is indicating, saying that's only 5%. So it seems to me he's within his rights to want to know the details of this. Mm-hmm. In terms of the value of the company, it's a pretty substantial platform. I mean, yes, it's not making money. Obviously, Musk's intentions were to create a business model where it would make more money. You know, not clear that that could happen, but is this also a vanity project for Musk? Maybe, and good for him. I mean, I'd love to see him, even if it doesn't make much money for him, really create an open, honest forum where everybody is treated the same. You know, there's a lot to like here. I think that Musk obviously bid too much, both, you know, before and after he made that bid. The tech stocks were under enormous pressure. They still are. Or at least maybe they're bottoming now. But, you know, I think he paid too much. I think you're right. My guess is there'll be another chapter, and it could be Musk who comes back and buys it, but at a lower price.
Steve Moore, I want to look at the politics of this. I mean, this is a front-page story. Every time Elon Musk attracts front-page coverage, all right, the mainstream media.
Well, you know, Larry, he's almost like Donald Trump the way he's dominating.
Yes. No, that's exactly. By the way, I called him he's the Donald Trump of Silicon Valley Wall Street. He's like gales of creative destruction. That's what Elon Musk does. Yeah. So this guy comes out, and the original thing, he wants to buy it to establish free speech. Right. The mainstream media hates free speech. And worse than that, he then comes out and says he's going to vote Republican in the congressional elections. And then even worse than that, Steve Moore, he comes out and says, look, I voted for this gal who won the congressional primary in South Texas. I don't remember her name. So he's just doing everything so that the mainstream media hates the guy. So what do you make of this?
Well, too bad he wasn't born in the United States, right? Or he could be the next Donald Trump. I want to respond to what you guys were talking about with respect to the business aspect of this. I never really got understood by Twitter. Why not just start your own Twitter? I mean, you know, for tens of billions of dollars, this idea that these big, you know, tech platforms are monopolies is crazy. This is the Wild West out there. And it seems to me that, you know, our guys should do what Trump and others are trying to do is just create alternative platforms that don't discriminate against conservative voices. And they can do quite well out there. So, you know, he should take the – how much was he going to buy it for? $30 billion?
Think of the platform.
What was it?
44.
Yeah, think of what he could build with $44 billion. So by the way, my kids don't really use Twitter anymore. They've moved on to TikTok and other, you know, other kinds of platforms. So, you know, this is an always evolving, internet. And you put it very well. There's these creative gales of destruction, especially in social networking.
He's a disruptor. He is like Trump. By the way, I just want to say proudly, we have this burgeoning Instagram site.
Uh-huh.
For me and the show. I mean, it's really cool, and people are responding. Well,
exactly my point, Larry. That's exactly my point. Do you have a Twitter account? You probably do.
Well, I used to be very, very active on Twitter.
Right.
And then I went to Washington, and I stopped for obvious reasons.
Right.
Also, you know, I had a lot of followers, but I grew weary. Like, my followers, many of them defended me, but the people that don't like me, I mean, they're poisonous. I mean, I got tired of reading them. It's like, I said, I'm not really that bad. I mean, it's just that. But Liz, is it? I mean, it kind of gets to you. You know, you dial up your Twitter account before you go to bed, and you see with these attacks on you, and you can't sleep all night. It's like I'm a murderer, killer.
Are you still killing those puppies?
Yes, that's what it's like. But Liz, how, I mean, is it, to Steve's question, would must be, I mean, how hard is it to start one?
Very hard. What Trump has tried to do, and it's just not, in my view, it's not really going anywhere. Parler is maybe a good example, too, because you actually have very smart, very capable people behind that platform, and it still is actually nowhere. Look, Twitter is different than, Steve, what your kids are interested in. Twitter has become sort of the go-to place for people who do what we do. I mean, it's very, very active, actively used by people in the media, people who want to promote television and things they write, et cetera, et cetera. It's a little different. Instagram
politics
is a different thing. TikTok's really different. Twitter has a real place, and I think it's not easy to create something like this, is the answer.
By the way, Steve Moore, I want to throw TikTok out of the country. Yeah. TikTok is an instrumentality of the Chinese Communist Party. All the user information goes right to their central committee, by law, by Chinese law. And Trump tried to sell it to get rid of it. We couldn't do that. The clock ran out. I want to get rid of TikTok. That's Chinese spying operations, all it is.
Well, you may be right about that. And the fact that China is really emerging in these social media platforms is all the more reason we shouldn't tear down ours. You know, I don't understand
yes.
this word.
No, that's a great point.
Amazon. Yeah. I mean, the only benefits of all this antitrust legislation, I'm very worried about this Klobuchar bill that went break up big tech. And a lot of my conservative friends on Capitol Hill are in favor of that. The problem is the big beneficiaries of that are going to be the Chinese.
Mm. You know what? I think you're absolutely right. You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. And we should have strict espionage laws, which we actually do. We have CFIUS, but they get away with murder, and that's not good. Robert Robert O'Brien and John Ratcliffe and I are going to, you know, we wrote this letter with a whole bunch of other people to Pelosi and Biden and Schumer. Of course, got nowhere, but we're going to put an op-ed piece up in the Journal, you know, making the case again. Because
about TikTok?
Well, Liz, it's more general that O'Brien is the leader here, National Security Advisor. What you were saying, as Steve was saying, if you tear down our tech companies, whether they're social media or tech, and some of the companies do both, and they do some great work. For example, in artificial intelligence, we're the world leader. It's coming from these companies. And we don't want to slaughter them. We don't want to destroy them because you're helping China.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a key point. And look at Steve Mnuchin, at Trump's direction, tried to sell. You know, we're looking at deals with TikTok and ByteDance, the parent.
Right.
We thought we had a deal with Microsoft. It just didn't pan. We didn't have enough time. That's the basic point. But I think, I'd like to throw them out. All right. Let's take a quick break. Liz Peek, folks, Fox News contributor, Steve Moore, FreedomWorks Committee to Unleash Prosperity. I'm Larry Kudlow. When we come back, we are going to look at a very interesting story written by Kim Strassel, The Wall Street Journal. And the title of the story is Won't Biden Fire Anyone? We will carve that up. I have about 100 names that he should fire on my list. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
All right. Welcome back, folks. We're here talking money and it was a good stock market section for this. Really good.
Anyway, Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, financial columnist, and Steve Moore at FreedomWorks and Unleash Prosperity and Gubzilla. So can we talk about this Kim Strassel article? I mean, here's this guy, Biden, really surrounded by dummies, okay? Dummies. And his whole presidency has collapsed for all the reasons that the three of us have talked about for the last year plus. And he hasn't fired anybody. He hasn't fired his economics people. He hasn't fired his goofy climate change radicals. He hasn't fired his national security people. In just 18 months, he's taken a very strong economy, running it into the ground. COVID disaster, Afghanistan disaster, right? Drug shortages, border disasters, inflation disasters, energy disasters, baby formulas, and nobody gets fired in the Biden administration. Steve Moore, I go to you. How can this be? How dumb can he be?
So we have a big study that will be coming out in a couple of days, Larry. So I'll give you the kind of scoop on this on the Kudlow Show. We looked at the top 80 appointees in the Biden administration that deal with economics and commerce. And the median years of business experience is zero. Zero.
Wow.
More than half have no business experience. The mean is about 2 years of business experience. So these people don't know anything about anything. And they are, you're right, they are ideologues. And by the way, in the Trump administration, you know, it was, you know, 6 or 7 years of business experience. So in the Biden administration, they're all lawyers, activists, university professors, or just people who've been involved in politics their whole life. And you look at these people like Jennifer Granholm and Pete Buttigieg, would you even hire them to run a lemonade stand? Mm. I mean, really, they are complete ideologues who've never run or managed anything. None of them have been fired. And I think that's because this is what Biden wants. He wants ideologues in these positions. And one last thing about this. If Joe Biden called me tomorrow and said, Steve, call me and I want your advice about what to do. What Joe Biden needs to do if he's going to save his presidency is I would tell him, you know what, hire somebody like a Fred Smith or an Elon Musk or someone who knows something about just the logistics and running things. Just put them in charge. You go out and give your speeches. Put somebody in charge who knows something. There's nobody, Larry, who's over there that you would trust with the economy or national security. I can't think of a single one. I thought it would be Janet Yellen, but she's been a profound disappointment.
Well, I agree. You know, we had, Liz, we had in the Trump group a ton of people who came out of business. You know, just at our level, you had Wilbur Ross, right, was the Commerce Secretary.
Yep.
You had Steven Mnuchin at Treasury, had spent all those years at Goldman Sachs and then, you know, became a banker and a movie producer. I mean, we understood business. I spent all those years on Wall Street. I mean, you don't have that, Liz. And it shows. And I think that Kim Strassel's exactly right.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I think, though, none of us should be surprised by this. This was also the game plan in the Obama White House. I remember writing columns about how there was no business expertise in the Obama White House. In fact, I wrote a thing for the Daily Beast about, you know, the Obama kids should start a lemonade stand to Steve's point, just because someone in the White House should know about profit and loss. That is not what motivates or guides Democrat policymaking. They don't really look for effectiveness. They don't look for answers. They look for checking ideological boxes that kind of are sort of pleasing to their base. But I think now the Biden administration is in such a pickle. I mean, I went online this morning and looked, as I frequently do, at his approval ratings. It is unimaginable that they're getting worse, but they are. And you know,
what was the number? What's the latest number?
Well, I think it was 38, but one of them out there is pretty credible as 36. And I mean, that's just really horrible.
Isn't he in the on the economy stuff, inflation and so forth? Isn't he like in the high 20s?
Well, and by the way, with some subgroups like young people and Hispanics in the 20s, I mean, you know, no one imagined it would be this bad. But as far as I can see, it is not going to get any better because they have no solutions to anything. And I think Kim's right that at a point like this, and I'd say particularly after the midterms, this will be true, they have got to do something to show that they're at least aware. And in this man's case, that is an uphill battle to convince Americans that he's aware of anything, but at least they understand things aren't going well. And honestly, the way he trots around the country talking about how great his economy is, you know, it sounds like he doesn't understand.
Let me just read you something real quick from this. Homeland Security Alexandra Mayorkas might be handling a border crisis were he not busy interviewing Mary Poppins to head a disinformation board. Attorney General Merrick Garland is too tied up tracking parents at school board meetings and tackle violent crime. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland blew through a deadline for a new offshore leasing plan to increase oil supply, focused as she is on creating a truth and healing commission. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, charged with unsnarling COVID supply chain snags, was last seen unveiling a $1 billion pilot project to promote racial equity in America's roads. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra was last seen never. Right? I mean, Javier is probably the best politician in the lot because he's just under the desk. He doesn't want to even show up. But
well, Larry, I think a corollary to this is also that apparently the rate of staff exiting the White House is at unprecedented levels. And, you know, the Trump White House had some chaotic moments, to be sure, and a lot of people didn't last. This one apparently is off the charts. I wasn't even aware of that. But there is it's just in terrible shape.
You know, the other side is the national security side with the bungling in Afghanistan, which in many ways I think was the beginning of the end of the Biden presidency. I mean, everything seemed to fall apart. But you had, they're always a dollar short and a day late in the Ukraine. Blinken goes to Alaska to some meeting with the Chinese high command, and all they do is yell at him, and he doesn't say anything. Their diplomacy is broken. The military stuff, I mean, really, General Milley, is more interested in a woke military, it seems, than he is to, bolstering our defenses against our enemies. And I thought for sure after Afghanistan, heads would roll, but they never did.
You know, you're right about what's going on in the Defense Department. I've talked to a number of people who are telling me exactly what you just said, and these are pretty high-level reps who've been in the Defense Department for many years. They're saying that the number one priority of our military right now and the brass at the top is climate change, not keeping our country safe. I mean, so everything is green energy stuff, with our tanks and our planes and so on. So it is a danger to the security of this country, no question about it.
I mean, here you got Yellen, who runs around the globe talking about the existential climate change risk, right? And telling everybody the solution to $100 oil and a little less than $5 gasoline is renewables. I mean, it's not credible. Nobody believes that. I mean, then you have this guy, the one running the EPA, Liz, now wants stricter and stricter ozone regulations.
Yeah.
Which would shut down the Permian Basin, which produces 43% of our oil.
I read about that because my head exploded when I saw that.
Really?
That came out after the week in which everybody in the world, including Democrats, were hammering Joe Biden on the gasoline prices and not producing enough gas, oil and gas at home. How could they even contemplate? Does that guy ever talk to the White House? Does he read the newspapers? How could they contemplate impacting Permian Basin output? And by the way, it's not just 43% of production. It's 40% of drilling. So it's not like an old field that isn't necessary to our future. They don't have any solutions. And I think at the end of the day, they're going to have to, I think Kim's right, they're going to have to fire a whole bunch of people just to tell the country we care, because that is what the messaging problem is right now, according to Democrats. Americans don't feel that Joe Biden understands how bad things have gotten. And by the way, there's another thing we haven't talked about, and not many people are talking about, which is COVID. COVID is actually not great right now. We've got cases and hospitalizations increasing. The FDA is dragging their feet. I would argue, actually, the Afghanistan thing began the polling slide, but so did the fact that you had a surge in COVID after Biden did a victory lap and said it was over. It's not over, and this could be the next big thing.
Thanks, kids. Liz Peek and Steve Moore, thank you ever so much. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. Dial us up on the Fox Business Show, 4 to 5 p.m. every day, and I'll be here next Saturday. Thanks for listening.